Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri, Personal Democracy Media, and you are listening to the latest in the ongoing series of Personal Democracy Plus conference calls that we do here regularly with movers, shakers, thinkers, doers in the field of political technology, civic engagement, online media, you name it. And this week, we're looking forward to talking with Connor White Sullivan, who is has the distinction, which it will be hard to for him to lose, of having been the youngest speaker ever to grace the stage of Personal Democracy Forum. That was actually, I think, 2 years ago, was it not? Or
about 2.5 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, when he was just finishing up his undergraduate studies and running a really interesting project called Localocracy, which we're going to be talking about a bit on this call. He has already burned through that achievement by selling Localocracy to AOL and the Huffington Post, which is where he is working now, doing editorial technology and product development around community engagement. And really looking forward to talking with Connor, who has and continues to be at the cutting edge of thinking and working on this problem of how you do community engagement in an age where we are all networked and where there are new possibilities to connect people online and offline. And so we're going to come at it from several different angles. And I promise, Connor, that we're not going to get into trade secrets of what's being cooked up at the Huffington Post, but maybe we can get him to, you know, pull the curtain back a little bit and share with us some of what he's thinking about and learning. So without any further ado, welcome, Connor. And you know, it would be great if you maybe, you know, quickly gave us a little bit of your history and you know, why you started Localocracy, what was your, you know, your goal, what you learned from it, and how, you know, you're applying the lessons learned to your new work in terms of online and offline community engagement, whether it's Huffington Post or other big sites that have, you know, big digital footprints, what we can learn from all of that. So take it away.
Sure. So the way... I guess the way I'll start the story is in 2008, I had been studying anthropology, and I'd been really interested in how technology changes culture. You know, when you look back to from the Stone Age to agriculture to, you know, the Industrial Revolution, every time we've had major changes in technology and especially major changes in communication, it's led to some pretty significant cultural and political changes that followed. So I was really interested in and I'd started sort of studying and researching how the internet could be having an impact in culture and was getting really interested in some of the theoretical stuff that was getting written. I was really interested in like Yochai Benkler and all the stuff that Clay Shirky and all the other sort of people that are in the PDF circles were interested in. And then I remember I was up late in the library one night, and a friend of mine, I had been studying Arabic, and a friend of mine was from Saudi Arabia. And he showed me a website that, or he showed me a Facebook page that had been launched a few days before. And it was actually I saw the April 6th movement as it was written in Arabic, like just as it was getting going in 2008 with the first strikes that started to happen, coordinated by Facebook and text messaging. And so I started to think that, you know, as the web took this power of people connected, this sort of new infrastructure was starting to be used to change politics. And so I decided that was the area that I really wanted to work in. At the same time, you know, the Barack Obama movement was sort of like, especially for people in college, it was sort of sweeping across the country. I had ended up going down to help out in some of the primaries. And when the summer came along, I had actually been, before that, you know, I'd done like grassroots marketing for a natural beverage company before, and then I'd been a construction worker, but I decided I wanted to get into organizing. So the first thing I could do that was remotely in that space, because I had no experience, was actually going door to door as a canvasser, working for an environmental organization that was trying to pass state legislature, pass some climate change legislature and carbon tax legislature through the Massachusetts State Senate. But as I was going door to door in this sort of kind of industrial sort of minded organization where we were knocking on doors, asking for, you know, petition signatures and donations, I was running into people so that we could pay lobbyists and pay ed ops writers. I was running into people who just because it was, you know, Cambridge and Boston and there were, I mean, you couldn't really throw a rock without hitting a PhD student of some kind. So I was finding people who actually had really specific domain knowledge and also just had personal life stories that were really relevant, but they weren't being connected with their legislators and they weren't being connected with their neighbors. And to me, that felt like an incredibly missed opportunity. So I was actually only there for, you know, probably a month and a half or so before I got an opportunity because I was doing, you know, I was doing okay as a canvasser goes. And because I'd done some other, you know, I'd organized a lot of my friends when I was doing the marketing things for that beverage group. I had a little bit of experience in terms of like starting new things. So they were opening an office with another related organization to help register low-income and minority voters in Virginia, which was going to be a swing state. So I packed up my stuff. I moved down to Virginia, and I, along with two others, I opened that voter registration office there and, you know, spent the rest of the summer sort of going into low-income and minority communities and registering voters and hiring and canvassing staff and finding out, you know, I got a bunch of local businesses to let us use their property to canvass on and worked a little bit with churches to try and get their membership registered. And that was also a great experience, but then ended up coming back because I wanted to do more stuff that was directly online. And so when I came back, I was still in college, but the campaign for sensible marijuana policy in the Committee for Sensible Marijuana Policy in Massachusetts was getting going on a campaign to decriminalize marijuana in Mass. And so I ended up getting a position there as the Western Mass field coordinator, sort of coordinating campus representatives and other folks across 13 districts in Western Mass, where I was using online and some offline stuff. And we use Facebook a lot in terms of trying to coordinate our membership and trying to bring new people in. And we built some pretty big Facebook groups, but the sort of feeling I got out of that was that, you know, the Facebook page was basically just a digital lapel pin, you know, or a digital pin. It was, you know, you could have a million strong for Barack Obama, but, you know, you've got a million strong for cheese pizza. It wasn't really anything that you could use as a qualified pool for organizing, and it wasn't something that you could really use to sort of pressure anyone. But it was just a good way for the idea to spread virally. It was a good way for sort of people to have conversations with their friends, and there was plenty of value to it, but it wasn't super useful as an organizing tool when we were trying to find point people and we were trying to find all sorts of other stuff. So I started to get the idea of what would happen if you could the other thing that happened was while I was down south, I was also while I was in Virginia, I was actually staying on couchsurfing. There was a network of 2 million people who've said, you know, various other people who have been sort of validated for reputation by other community members on that site can crash on my couch. So I had had a real, like my life had actually been directly impacted by this decentralized network that had a trust system in it. So I was really interested in how that could be used. And I was interested in how would we build a new sort of political infrastructure where you could get the best ideas from people, because I met a lot of people who had very different ideas than I did on how we should govern and how various policies should be adapted to their communities. And my sense was in these sort of times where we've got, you know, exponential change happening, especially from a tech sector, and especially if you look at how the workforces are changing and all sorts of other things, I saw big difficulties in the education system, big difficulties in the energy system. You know, when we end up hitting peak oil, which will happen at some point, you know, how are we going to make these massive changes? And to me, I felt like people needed to feel like they were empowered and they were a part of making the change work in their community. It wasn't just about a top-down change coming. So while I enjoyed the Obama movement, I felt like a lot of people were sort of putting their hopes in, if we just elect one person, it'll actually change things. And I really didn't feel like that was the case. I felt like if we were going to actually change anything about our society, we needed to really have people empowered at the most local level where they could have real influence. And so I started to think about how that could happen online. And then the whole, I'm kind of, tell me if I'm going too long on the early part of the story.
Well, get us to Localocracy.
Yeah, so basically that got me to Localocracy. And so Localocracy was then, it was the idea that I had cooked up, you know, through that, or cooked up. And then I actually competed in a bunch of, I joined the UMass Entrepreneurship Initiative. I had originally not known that I was going to start a company with it. I was just felt like I needed to find software engineers. I hadn't actually been a sort of software engineer guy, and so I was going to the Entrepreneurship Initiative to try to find those sort of people. And then I found pretty quickly that you can't just find engineers for your product. You have to really earn them, because you know, you can see their code, but they can't really see what your skill set is, or why you should be the sort of person who they'll want to work with or for. So I had to find a way to get validated, and ended up winning a few business plan competitions and a few things. And so we started the company with $10,000 that I won through those competitions. And after that, I'd also gotten a few other folks who, you know, had some a lot of great tech and experience. Actually, after I won that prize, one of the first things I ever spent it on was my ticket to PDF. That was actually the first thing I spent that prize money on, was I went out to PDF in 2009. And that's where I met, you know, Jim Gilliam, who runs 3DNA, and he was running White House 2 at the time, and I met a bunch of other great folks. Jim actually was the guy who a few other folks I knew back from Amherst were the ones who screened my potential tech co-founders. So actually, like, PDF sort of was there right at the beginning of Localocracy, in terms of that community. And then Aaron and I, my co-founder Aaron Soles, we ended up building the company. Scott Hefferman from Meetup had randomly, I don't know how he saw it, but he randomly saw a 5-minute Ignite talk I gave that fall before we launched, and he invited me to come speak at the New York Tech Meetup, and then. That's where I met Andrew. That's how I ended up. And we launched then, and so we launched our first thing, which was a platform where we confirmed that registered voters using real names were on the site from that community, and they could, you know, say what the issues were, and people could vote for and against them and rank the best reasons. Our goal was, it was sort of a two-sided petition that we could use to, one, help people who didn't know too much about the issue really learn about the issue quickly and see it from a sort of a fair and balanced perspective, and then also because it was real people in that town, they could sort of much more directly influence their elected representatives. And so started with one town, you know, kept growing it out, and you know, most of the issues that ended up happening were issues around schools, issues around roads and property taxes, and as we grew it, we found that, you know, we needed to find a way to pay the bills. And so we actually started working with news organizations, because we found that political, you know, people who were elected weren't really interested in paying anyone to make their lives more difficult by, you know, like aggregating this sort of constant town common. But news organizations were really interested in that, because we were getting some really great participation from people and some really high quality comments that people hadn't seen before, because, you know, on this site, what people said actually could have a real influence in what happened in their town. So people got really engaged and put a lot of thought into it. And so the newspaper started working with us on.
Yeah. I mean, we've covered Localocracy in the past. I think it's useful, you know, if maybe drill down just a little bit further on what was the, I guess Amherst was probably the most robust iteration of it. It was your first one. So how many people got involved? You know, what did you need to do to get folks involved? You know, any sense that at some point it sort of took off on its own, or, you know, started to have a life of its own? What was the, you know, give us the best case scenario, if you will,
so
how it worked.
The key thing for us was users had to feel like what they were participating in was going to have some level of impact in their community and really matter. And so the truth is, for a hyperlocal initiative, especially a hyperlocal political initiative. We didn't have any sort of, like, at the time there was no, you know, Occupy Wall Street, no sort of mass media push that said people should have get involved in a way that's not the normal political system. So our user base was, we were expanding beyond, a lot further beyond the people who were normally going to town meetings. But at the same time, you know, these were communities where maybe 5,000 people were voting in local elections, and, you know, we'd have 100 to 300 people participating in these debates and a few thousand people coming in and watching them regularly. So these were not huge in terms of numbers ever, just because of the area that we were interested in.
Yeah, but the town, I mean, what percentage of the local adult population are we talking about, though?
So what we had was sort of our implied penetration, which is out of the number of people who live in that town, we would compare our page views and we compare our registered users to it. And so when you're looking at that, you want to compare it also to, like, the people who make the effort to turn out to vote. So in a town where, like, where 5,000 people vote in the election and we'd regularly be getting, you know, like, 8,000, 10,000 people looking at the site and a few hundred, like, we would get around 300 people participating actively.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that to us was a pretty good penetration because we were getting more than the normal interest to vote would be coming and checking out these local issues, and more than the 5 to 10 people who would come and speak publicly were weighing in. So we ended up working on, and this was sort of what we were working on when we ended up being acquired, was more broad-based sort of community-building solutions and more broad-based ways of generating high-quality user engagement that we started licensing to newspapers. So those were the things, you know, at the end of the day, the town common thing eventually sort of became kind of like the passion project that we kept running because we felt it was civically important, but the core aspects of our business were actually trying to appeal to much larger, much larger communities and doing something that was a little bit less specified, because we found that, you know, at that time there weren't as many people who really cared about their local community, and you can't really convince people to care unless you've got, you know, some larger movement or some larger arm. We were just providing the tool for them to participate, and we had to kind of count on what people wanted to do. And we were able to make it easy enough that more people, you know, there's always this threshold on the internet between how much time and how much energy people are willing to commit and what their motivation is. And so we were able to lower the amount of time and energy it took to have a meaningful impact in that town. But we also had to do things to try and, like, raise the motivation, which is, you know, we would find ways to make sure that, you know, through their interaction, they'd end up, you know, some of the things that we did that ended up building the community faster were, like, we'd only launch in towns when a certain number of people had signed up in advance. And then we would have a weekly email that would be shot out with the issue of the week, and as users participated, that would gain, like, guarantee that they'd be able to bring back that larger community. So there were a few things that we sort of worked on, but as we were building the site up, it was really, I think one of our main challenges, in fact, was for that aspect of the business, we had to deal with what people's actual motivations were for local engagement.
So are you saying, Connor, that actually getting people to engage online at the very local level was, in your experience with Localocracy, much harder than it appears, that you didn't have sustained engagement? I think that's what I'm sort of hearing in between the lines here.
Yeah.
That, you know, so can you
Well,
can
it
really...
wasn't so much that, right? It was, the key is, we did have sustained engagement, but actually what we found were the issues that were getting sustained engagement weren't happening every single day, right? So actually we had really high engagement in these local level issues when there were local issues that actually engaged people. I think the question is also, do you go beyond the people who already care? So there is a core group of people, like, we had a lot of involvement from parents and from property, like people who paid their taxes and the people who voted. Breaking that barrier from the people who already care enough that they're reading the local news, and this is also why we started, like, selling software to newspapers and building there, was because we found that, you know, our audience is the same audience that is reading the news on a regular basis because they're already somewhat informed and have a desire to be engaged. I guess our original thought was you would get more people engaged than had ever been engaged before, but I think the reason we ended up working with media organizations is because you tell folks a story, and that makes people want to engage, and then you give them an avenue for engagement. It wasn't actually just enough for us to provide an avenue for engagement. We have to provide a reason for them to want to,
right.
Which kind of works well in the narrative sense,
right.
Which is
what
the reason
think?
That we ended up working with newspapers
okay. so,
and
so,
news organizations.
Just for to stay in this for one more second, you know, the closest comparison I can think of to you know, what you were doing with Localocracy is the folks at Front Porch Forum who, you know, grew out of, you know, initially the need for some newcomers to a neighborhood in Burlington
yep.
to, you know, connect with their neighbors. And, you know, what they did was more email list, you know, than web-based. And it was also really, really local. I mean, you know, each one of those forums are 150 neighbors, you know, who are really clustered around a common block or, you know, a few streets. Whereas here you were doing a whole town. And, you know, the truth is that, you know, I may really, really care about stuff within a two-block radius of where I live. But if there's, you know, a problem with the ball field on the other side of town that I don't really go to all that often, it's still in my town, but I may not really have a reason to, you know, engage around that thing as much. And so, you know, it's almost as if there's like a prime number here, you know, 150 comes up because it's the Dunbar number, that, you know, where you can really get sustained conversation among real neighbors. And then when you get up to the sort of the town level, even if it's just 5,000 people, you know, you're actually now dealing with a more select group of people who, you know, there's sort of the hardcore folks who are really civically engaged, and then the others who kind of drop in and out when, you know, there's some hot issue that's roiling the town. Is that like sort of, I mean, and so in some ways Localocracy was working that second level.
So that may be, that could be along those lines. I think the other question is, so for instance, I know Michael Woods Lewis real well, and if you ask him the sort of things that do well on Front Porch Forum,
right?
The things that do well on Front Porch Forum are things like missing cat, you know,
right.
Are the things like, you know, I lost Fluffy, or like, who's got a radiator repairman recommendation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And those are sort of things that are, I think, incredibly important because they help people live their lives. The thing that we were sort of pushing that may not have been right at the time for this, and this is one of the reasons we had pivoted the business model, you know, I think we started pivoting the business model soon after I spoke at PDF. So it was actually, you know, more than a year before we sold it, we had started to sort of transition the company.
Mm-hmm.
But the original sort of sense was, you know, we're focusing on people who are trying to make, who feel empowered and want to make their community a better place and want to think about important issues from a very local perspective. And, you know, so we, what we found, I guess, was that you can make something that's really engaging for them. You need to do certain things to make sure you reach the critical mass so that it's really relevant to them. And,
right.
You know, that was things like we actually ended up getting really into email and doing a lot of work around, all right, how do we make sure we make sure everyone's attention is focused at the right time. And we did a lot of stuff around our design to make sure that it was easy for users to find the information that they needed and you know, very lightweight for them to engage. So, but you also have to deal with always that sense of, okay, how do we get people to feel empowered, like it's worth them thinking about doing that? And, you know, in some of these cases where you've got, like, really, you know, we found that the communities that were doing well were the communities where they actually had a relatively, responsive government where they felt like they were being listened to. And, you know, you have to get a lot more users there before you start to get the protest vote aspect of things. In general, the easiest way for us to get a lot of adoption was we started to have the site getting used by school committee members, by members of town meeting, by, you know, in South Abilene, we had the select board using it, and which is sort of like in those towns, they don't have mayors, they have, they have like sort of town council things. And those were the issues that ended up getting a lot of engagement. And then, yeah, that's also around the time that we started expanding into like the more news business aspect of things.
So what, bring us up to the present now. So you're at Huffington Post. You've been there now several months.
Yep. So I'll give the intermediate between as we were building these town commons. So we started building the software for basically, you know, news organizations to start to manage their communities, to start to work on user retention, to start to work on elevating the level of their comment stuff. And a lot of this stuff was sort of like a little bit more behind the scenes as we were developing it out. But as we were building this, and, you know, I spent a lot of time sort of, that was around the time we won the Poynter Prize in Entrepreneurial Journalism. We ended up raising investment from the Knight Foundation, and they were our first sort of, we were one of the first for-profit companies that they put a serious investment in. And, you know, which was only like $150,000 was our investment from them, but it was still sizable for us at the time. And then as we started growing out, we ended up getting approached by another media organization about being acquired. And we had actually had made contact with AOL pre-Huffington Post acquisition. And so it was actually through AOL channels that I ended up meeting Ariana. But basically, yeah, as we had been selling to newspapers, the interesting thing was as we were doing things around emails, we were doing things around, users like subscribing to different topics and users recruiting one another to answer questions and all sorts of other things, which we had started with moving the local Oxy platform sort of into something a little different. They had been asking us, can you make us more like Huffington Post, right? Like those were the sort of things that they were interested in, was building some high quality, you know, making it valuable to users so they could have high quality user engagement and also think about like the commenting community and a blogger community. So it was interesting when we got the offer to get acquired by Huffington Post. That was one of the core things that brought us here as opposed to somewhere else, was that, you know, we had already been looking at them and saw that was a place where they were doing a lot of innovation on the internet. It was a news organization that had been sort of focused on the internet from its very get-go, and we weren't having to deal with a print culture that was then transitioning over and didn't really understand the internet as well. They'd already sort of fully backed digital. So that was the reason that we ended up, when we made our decision, we ended up coming here. So anyways, so that brings you a little bit more into the present point where now I'm leading a small tech team. I'm the director of editorial technology, and we're building up sort of similar things that we'd been doing in the later days, but working on how we can, build new tools that will work across editorial, across the blogger community to make those communities denser, and then also things we can do on the commenting section that can help sort of elevate, high-value comments. And,
right. So community is not a word I usually use when I talk about the Huffington Post. And so let's take a moment. I know we're close to the halfway point, and I do want to open things up soon for people to ask questions, but I'm going to take a few minutes just to drill down on this with you. So community, to me, is a word that's thrown around a lot to describe online engagement, and it's often, a really hollow,
I agree.
Concept. And so to me, an online community is very different than an organization that has, say, an email list that it communicates to, in a one-way direction. Community is much more of a lattice of connections, some of which are just, one-to-one, and a lot of which are one-to-many. And the most, great examples of online community are sites like, say, Wikipedia, which has a very dense network of volunteer editors who, have built up a whole community of practice to the point where they have a daily newspaper that they publish about what's going on inside Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Daily Kos, another example of a site that has a really robust, community and sub-communities. There are pages on Daily Kos that never make it to the front page, but it's, the people who are members of the site once a week getting together to talk about gardening or getting together to talk about being single and or, you know, people who are going through a grieving process and, you know, want to support each other because they're dealing with bereavement. Those all exist inside Daily Kos, and, you know, they're part of why that place grows, because people
yes.
are actually touching each other and making real connections. Reddit and all the subreddits on Reddit.
Yes.
When I think of Huffington Post, you know, I mostly think of, you know, this amazing, you know, front page that drives huge amounts of traffic to, you know, specific posts that, you know, featured bloggers write for the site, as well as, you know, other things that the editors think are important or interesting, and a lot of really smart search optimization. So, you know, topics that are hot in the news right now are often also going to be very well covered by Huffington Post. And then I see, you know, lots of posts that get comments, but it's hard to say that, you know, there's community there. So
yes.
tell me why, you know, how would you describe the community that's there? You know, what are we missing? Maybe I'm missing part of the picture.
Well, I actually think you have a relatively accurate you're somewhat accurate in the sense of how things are right now. I think there are a lot of smaller communities that end up getting developed that aren't necessarily the whole Huffington Post community. So,
give me an example of one.
So, for instance, we try to make an effort to help bloggers bring in, you know, an audience of their own, right? So users can subscribe to various bloggers, and when users connect their Facebook or their Twitter account, it actually will send them an email alert whenever, you know, someone that they follow on Twitter or they're friends with on Facebook posts a blog app. So those are like some of the things that we work on right now, or like those are things that have already existed as we came in to help those, like those bloggers, even when they're not landing on the front page, as they attract fans and followers, they also have, you know, they've got people who can keep coming back to their article or their blog, and we can give them not just a megaphone when they speak out to the whole Huffington Post audience, but as people get really interested in what, you know, for instance, like I get emails all the time when Larry Lessig posts, right, and when Craig Newmark posts. Like those are two of the bloggers that I follow that post probably most regularly. So that's I think for one example of how we try to build these like denser communities around individual
mm-hmm.
bloggers.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're also right in that, you know, we recognize that there's still a long way to go to have those super dense networks, right? The Huffington Post is, we have some super active commenters who get to know one another, and, you know, you'll actually see them going back and forth in the comment section, and sometimes they'll take comment threads offline, they'll be replying to one another, and it'll be somewhat off topic, but it's them sort of building up their community. And that's for our most prolific commenters, so that I consider to be a little bit of a different community. But you also have bloggers who, you know, blog back and forth to one another. So I think that's something that you can find those dense communities at scale, but then there are also things that you can build that can make that more accessible for people who aren't super regulars coming in all the time. And that's
right.
what we try to do as users connect their Facebook and as users connect their Twitter. And as they make use of the features to like follow the bloggers that they really care about. But in general, we've been working on tech things that will make that more obvious to users. Because there are things, you know, the Huffington Post has been really good at launching new features really quickly and iterating on them sort of constantly. And so
mm-hmm.
I think one of the reasons that they wanted to acquire us too is because of the way we've thought about community, you know, from that super dense level where we needed those communities for those to be successful, because there was a relatively limited targeted audience in those. For us to be successful in them, we needed those people to be like super connected. And we needed to like create really great tools for them to bring new people in and for them to keep one another engaged. And so that's some of the stuff that we've been working on, is how to make, you know, the enormous commenting community we have, which can definitely be overwhelming,
right.
you know, and can definitely be, you know, comments can get lost in that. But at the same time, we do things like, you know, if you look at our pundit boxes, or you look at, you know, all the super user and the comment moderator badges that users can earn, there are ways that people become a little bit more, at least regulars who are consistently posting interesting comments, can end up sort of feeling like they're they're part of a denser community than the looser networks. But I think I think in general you hit some of our key strengths like pretty well, right? Like this has been a site that has an incredible reach, and that's one of the reasons that people want to blog for us. And you know, we've done our best to build some tools that will help those bloggers grow their own audience and also keep that audience together. But there are
right.
always things you can do better. And
right.
that's
well, I'm
going to
open things up
on.
Now for folks who are listening. If you have a question or a comment that you'd like to bring to the conversation, just hit *6 on your phone, and I will try and pull you in. We'll give folks a second if anybody wants to do that. I want you to think about something, Connor. Okay, we have a question here in the queue. Hang on one sec. Go ahead. You should be unmuted.
Hi. Sounds like me. Thank you, Connor. A pleasure to meet you. And
tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Sure. My name is John Paris. I head up mobile and tablet strategy for Time Inc. And just joined Personal Democracy Media recently because of this whole area of digital and democracy, and especially relating to local issues, very much interests me. I'm actually a former journalist before I got into IT. So I just want to kind of bore you with a product-related question.
Sure.
I'm just very curious whether on the Huffington Post product roadmap will be integrating some elements of localocracy to, I'm mangling it.
Yeah.
Into mobile.
It was the difficulty of the name that made people remember it, which is actually the nice corollary, because users had to say it four times the first time they heard it. So
just curious if on your product roadmap will be some integration into Huffington Post's iPhone, iPad apps, et cetera.
Sure. So the short answer, I guess, is to some extent, yes. I mean, I can't talk too specifically on the things that we have launched for 2012 or we have in the roadmap for 2012, for obvious reasons. But we're taking mobile and tablet really seriously, and so I think whenever things are put in the roadmap, we're thinking about how we can do those, do this for mobile and do this for tablet. And we've also been thinking, you know, myself and our engineering team, as we came in, we sort of. I think it's important to realize that there are very, very big differences between, you know, local communities and a huge broadcast audience and the communities that you can build around that, around topic areas and around, you know, around that news. So we're very intentional about that, about not sort of taking things that we did at Localocracy, you know, as that community platform wholesale, or even the things we did for local newspapers wholesale.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've definitely spent a lot of time with the editorial team. We spent a lot of time with the existing sort of community moderation team and the people who know our commenters really well and know our bloggers really well, and have sort of been optimizing what the ideal products are to roll out. Plus, it's
sure.
different programming language, so we have to rebuild everything.
But, of course, mobile technology might enable you to leverage geolocation.
Definitely.
And
yeah.
Serve up the appropriate content. Very, very, very interesting. Thanks for your answer.
No problem. Great.
Thank you. And thanks for that question. If anyone else has a question, feel free to hit *6. I'll pull you in. Connor, I was going to ask you if you could give us an example of a blogger on Huffington Post who you think has, you know, done some smart things in terms of developing a real online community, you know, given that they seem to be the real hubs for that kind of engagement. Because there's no question that the social side of the site is very rich. If you're a person who has taken the time to play with those tools, you know, you've definitely gamified, a lot of those aspects of engagement, with the badges and showing people their stats and so on. So, you know, the positive reinforcement is there. But, you know, if you go back to my examples of Wikipedia or Daily Kos or, you know, Reddit, one reason why online community works, seems to me, when it does work, is it isn't just that you know, the site has been designed well to, you know, reward positive behavior. It's also that people have a common goal of some kind, right?
Yeah.
So what's the common goal around news? You know, what can you imagine, you know, what are you seeing in terms of, you know, understanding where the sort of the hot spots are on the Huffington Post? What, you know, can you shed some light on that?
So one thing I can mention is there's two kinds of communities that can form, right? There's the community that is the subset of your friends that are caring about the same sort of things,
mm-hmm.
the people that you already know in real life. And then there's the larger, you know, there's the folks that you know we're the folks that really care about the same thing and are drawn for the same reasons, and those are the communities that are sort of brought together by content. And so, you know, I think you can clearly see on the politics verticals, right? Like the folks who have been there for a while and, you know, who have their politics bloggers and also the politics reporters that they follow. And you'll see commenters who comment on the same sort of things and comment, respond to the same other commenters. You know, it's easier to see because it's so, like, such high scale, it's easier to see on the back end. But then, you know, I mean, I can only think of the bloggers that I follow. But I think one of the interesting things is...
Well, let's take Larry Lessig as a good example. You know, do you think he... I mean, he may not even be aware of all the possibilities...
The bells and whistles and all the things. He may not. I mean, what I have found is that the value proposition of bloggers a lot of times is that it gives them a way, especially the bloggers who read the comments, because not all bloggers will spend time in their comment section.
Mm-hmm.
Some bloggers do. And bloggers who do, the reason that they sort of value it is because, one is because they can sort of build their own sort of loyal group, but especially, you know, when what they are posting is reaching a much larger audience than the audience that they would normally draw in, like if they were posting on their own blog or they're posting on a specialty sort of sites blog, they're able to get feedback on sort of what, I guess, a more broad population thinks about their idea and how articulate they're being and how much their message is resonating with, you know, I'd say a more open sample of Americans, right? So, for instance, if I post something on a PDF blog, like or on Tech President, or if I get something featured there, there's a lot of value to me to that because I'm really interested in the audience that's on Tech President, right? And I know that that's a group of people who really know and care about the same sort of things that I know and care about. And also you get that on our sub verticals and on our blogger page. You can start to like build those communities. We've been building those communities up, and so you can get the same thing if you're posting regularly on tech or
but
if you post
your
on
challenge,
but at the same
challenge.
Time you can also say that if this thing gets put on a main page, you're also going to have, you know, the ability to see how that idea is resonating with a larger group of people.
There's no question that, you know, everyone understands, I think, that you know, there's enormous value to being featured, you know, in the same way that getting on the CBS Evening News, you know, still has enormous value, though you reach a different audience, obviously. But I guess the challenge here, and I really don't want to sort of let you off this notion of community, right? Because the community is when people, you know, there's some sense of knowing each other, some sense of having a common – you know, something in common, right? And right now, we haven't quite gotten to where that is, where you think it's really alive and kicking, and where people are supporting each other in some way. And you know, so is this we're just looking in the wrong place, or is this a matter of design and, you know, features that need to be you know, worked on some more? I mean, is there community, you know, for argument's sake, around Arianna Huffington on the site? You know, one would think that, you know, given her prominence, and she often, you know, champions causes, right? So, I mean, is that where we should be looking for a model of what's possible? You know, my sense is that, you know, it's like you have a tremendous pile of raw material to work with here, And so you must have some sense of where, you know, already, you know, you've got coals glowing on the fire that you want to pour more fuel on.
Yeah, so I think Ariam is a great example. I mean, there are a few people that, like, I know who blog, and those are, I guess, the people that I guess I pay more attention to when I'm looking at the communities that we want to sort of foster and develop. You know, there are key bloggers, I think, that happen on the religion section, on the women's section, on the impact section especially. But, you know, those are places where communities can sort of become a little bit more richly fostered. I think you're right that, you know, there are product things you can do to develop communities more richly. The first thing is just making sure people have a feeling of space and have a feeling that, you know, there are other folks there that resonate with them. One of the things on our social news, like, we actually have a whole online community within the community. So we have a whole system of, like, friends and followers that gets, you know, the thing that I want to be clear on is, like, there are communities that get built by the users who have full knowledge of all the functionality on our site, and those communities grow. And then there's also, like, the support, like the audience that still hasn't been totally tapped all the way through. So I think there's a lot of room for growth, but I think we also have, you can look at networks and you can see there are plenty of people who have, you know, hundreds of other friends on the site just because they have favorited their comments or, you know, they have done other things. And those are the features that we're rolling out in this year. A lot of our stuff has been focused on Facebook and Twitter and growing that up, but I think a lot of the stuff that we have in the pipeline that's rolling out and, you know, Q1 and Q2, are actually really focused on helping surface that to more users, because some of our users really take advantage of the friends and the favoriting that you can do within the comments section, or just like being able to see what other friends have read your news article, like the same news articles. Because I think there's some community that happens because we reach such a large audience, there are like these other things that can happen that you don't necessarily see on the site. Like, you know, if I read an article, we actually had our whole social news feed, it's I guess about a year old now, but like when users have connected Facebook, they can see what other Huffington Post users who've enabled Facebook have also read. So that's one way people find out what their friends are reading, and that gives them a common language to talk about whatever the issues are that are resonating with each of them. So that's one aspect of community that's not the same as the Daily Coast community with people they don't know. And for that, we really count on the functionality that we have that isn't really tied to Facebook, which is our favoriting, and which is users like being able to subscribe to those bloggers. But, you know, we're also building a lot of other stuff.
Right. I'm going to pause again. If somebody who's listening wants to jump in with a question, feel free to hit *6 on your phone, and we will pull you in. Connor, here we go. We have a question, it looks like, from Washington, D.C., judging from your phone number. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, this is Albert. I do a lot of freelance writer and do a lot of work with community organizations. I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about, we're talking a lot about community, but wanted to know if there was a difference between just the kind of issue-specific communities and specifically political communities or those organized around political issues, as opposed to kind of social issues or, you know, a writer or anything else like that.
So
you're talking about on the Huffington Post site.
Right. You know, are you approaching, or is there a difference? Do you, obviously, you know, each community has their unique identity. Does one approach, though, you know, someone, you know, a community around politics is different than perhaps one around who's following entertainment or, you know, or sports or anything else like that.
Absolutely, right. So you have to, there are commonalities between them, right? But I think people identify with communities because it's a part of their personal identity, right? So when people feel really, really drawn to, being part of a larger group, there's some value that's happening for their life in that. And maybe that's because it's the identification with the idea, or it's the identification with the other people that they encounter during that idea that gives them a sense of self, against a sense of sort of like purpose in the world. I think you'll see, and so I think you definitely see more passion and more activity and more fervency around, you know, political communities that form around that. But I think the other sort of communities that can happen on more sort of lifestyle things, that's more people who are, you know, like, you know, if if you see people like, I don't have a great example from the lifestyle community side, but like sharing recipes and things like that, it's probably less important in their overall identity, but it may be a fun aspect of what they do. Like, so for instance, parenting communities are pretty active, right? Because they're all identifying with one another because they're going through a sort of a similar struggle. I guess that's in some way similar to the political fervency that happens around communities. Right now, you know, we don't do too many specific changes when we're talking about the different communities that we're sort of focused on building. We try and build, like, when we build new tech here, we build it basically based off of what we see as sort of editorial needs. And so, you know, we have editors who really care about their specific communities. So we'll get requests that come in from religion and from parenting and from, you know, other verticals, and we'll work on what can we build there. And we'll also try and see, like, what can we build there that's specific to them, and what can we build there that can be extrapolated across the rest of the site and into other verticals. I don't know if that answered your question at all, but hopefully
it answered a little bit. I guess the question is, do you think that, you know, as you move ahead, that there will be some different tools, you know, because, for example, there might be more passion, you know, in a political that there might be more burnout, you know, is there more burnout in terms of a conversation, you know, like those kind of things, and do you develop those tools specific to kind of help that community go
well,
through
Well, there
that?
Are some tools you develop specifically, right? Like we would never introduce we probably wouldn't roll out the petitioning, like if we rolled out something that had to do with, like, petitioning government, right? Like, we probably wouldn't roll that across the parents vertical. Maybe we would if the story's right, right? But that may not be something that, you know, you'd want to see on every single vertical.
Are you saying
so there may be some, like, and so those are some things where we've talked about doing stuff, but yeah.
Petitioning would be interesting, I think, actually, given you can certainly see, you know, change.org has found the sweet spot with you know, building community around grassroots petitions. Move On jumped in, I suspect, seeing how well change.org was doing with that, that clearly seems to be an instinctive, you know, move for a lot of people. You get fired up about something, you know, what can you do, right?
Yeah.
And so I was going to ask you about real time, you know, to what degree you're watching the sort of ad hoc communities that form around live events.
Yeah.
And whether, you know, you think there's some opportunities there, or you think anybody's doing anything interesting in that space.
So, who is doing interesting things around building community around live events? To me, I think the live events themselves, actually, like, this is going to be a terrible answer for you. I'm not going to help you out much at all. But I think, you know, live events are the place. I think there's a really important component to communities that are in person, right? And if you have a live event, you've already, like, achieved something by bringing people together in person. A key aspect is, like, how do you keep them together after that event is done?
No, let me
right?
give you an example of what I mean. I don't mean the community of, you know, 50,000 people all attending a U2 concert.
Yeah.
What I mean is, you know, State of the Union speech is going to happen in 3 weeks, and, you know, 10 million of us are going to have our laptops open while we're watching the speech live.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see TV programs now, you know, trying to get people to, you know, announce that, you know, I'm watching some, you know, crime show. You know, come chat with me about it while I do that. So that's what I mean by live events, not in-person events.
Yeah. So who have I seen building, like, in
communities?
Yeah,
or do you think
that?
There's an interesting opportunity here?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's obviously interesting opportunities you can have from Twitter. The question is, like, a lot of those are, like, a lot of the interactions that happen when those are hugely at scale become very fleeting, right? So, like, I do think you see the people who watch Twitter streams, like, during conferences, right, like, following one another, and there's some interesting things that can happen there around curation and aggregation. You know, I know, like, I'm interested in live stream and Ustream and the sort of interactions that people have by commenting on live videos. You know, but I think there's, like, I don't know that that's been broken open, you know, and I haven't personally had any, like, huge thoughts on those immediate events besides, like, besides the audience that's already online that's you know, looking at a common a common piece of content and the general challenges you have around building community around the people who are brought together as a like-minded audience and keeping them engaged with one another. So I think there are general thoughts, but I probably haven't had a lot of thoughts around live stream or around like the live events as much.
Just seems like an obvious opportunity for HuffPost, given the size of its daily audience.
Yeah.
You know, you have to surmise that when that audience is also paying attention to some breaking news story or just, you know, common political ritual, right, like watching the election returns on a primary night, that, you know, there's a possible opportunity to strengthen community there. Any last thoughts, just Connor, in terms of, you know, where you are, you know, where you're getting ideas from or you know, anything that you've seen bubble up in the last couple of months, not on Huffington Post, but elsewhere where you're just going, wow, you know, they're doing a good job. You know, we should all learn from X. Sort of last word opportunity here for you.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there are a few places where I've been like really – from a community perspective, I've been generally interested, right? Like I've been really interested in Quora. That's like one of the places, you know,
that's probably
biased for me, right? Because I've been always interested in, you know, real names and users, ranking ideas and things like that. But I've seen some really good contributions there. What time is it? So I've been interested in that. I've been interested in, that's probably outside of, I mean, I've been interested in, you know, I've obviously been paying attention to what other media organizations have been doing and how they've been approaching it. I still think that in terms of like online community, we're pretty far up there and, you know, but obviously we've got to keep an eye out on what everybody else is doing. But yeah, that's sort of, I don't know.
We're going to keep an eye on what you're doing too. I appreciate this chance to get under the hood with you a bit and not just to, hear your own story, but also, begin to get some of the flavor of, what you're wrestling with now at Huffington Post. There's an old saying, follow the alpha geek, see what they're up to, see what they're interested in. So we'll keep following you, Connor, and thank you for taking the time.
And I'll keep following today. PDF and the PDF community.
Yeah. Great. That's great to hear. Let me just say, as we finish the call, we've been talking with Connor White Sullivan from Huffington Post and formerly with Localocracy, talking about online community and tactics and strategies to strengthen community engagement online. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Connor, for your thoughts and for your time, and to everybody else. You've been listening to Personal Democracy Plus, and we'll see you online.